What I would call biblical creation is God created all things in six literal days by the power of His Word and Holy Spirit.
Dr. David Menton, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Those would be ordinary days, not some figurative concept of a day. Each characterized as having a sunrise and sunset. Normally, we don't go to those great lengths when we talk about days. People understand what we mean, particularly when we say first day, second day, third day. But God knew people would not want to believe this. And so He really beat a dead horse, I think, when He added, and oh, by the way, these days had mornings and evenings. If you want to get away from a day after that, you really have to do violence to Scripture.
You can listen to Dr. Menton's presentation, Making the Case for Creation, on an audio DVD from the 2015 Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 before Labor Day. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. If you had to pick a figure of history who embodies evil, one name, at least for us today, generally immediately comes to mind. Adolf Hitler, right? And we think of Adolf Hitler as a thoroughly evil man, maybe even an amoral man. Is that true? A man without an ethic, without a driving morality. Is that true? Is what he did and what all those who followed him did, is what he did driven by no ethic whatsoever, or perhaps an ethic that we need to examine a little closer? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us for the remainder of this hour on this Friday afternoon, August the 28th, to talk about the Darwinist roots of the Nazi worldview and the Nazi ethic, Dr. Richard Weikart. He's professor of history at California State University, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism in Germany. Dr. Weikart, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How can you explain, I guess kind of to set the stage, how can you explain Adolf Hitler's meteoric rise and then unbelievable popularity during his time as the leader in Nazi Germany?
Well, there were two key issues, really, that made him incredibly popular. One was the economic conditions, which were abysmal, as Germany was in the Depression, of course, just like the rest of the world in the early 1930s. And he was promising jobs. And actually, Germany did come out of the Depression faster than a lot of other countries. So the economic issues was very important. The second one was foreign policy. He was promising to make Germany great again. They'd suffered from a defeat in World War I, which had just shattered their pride, and he was building back up their pride. So those two things together, the fact that he was wanting to make Germany great again, and of course, in the early and mid-1930s, he was saying equal with other nations. He wasn't yet tipping his hat that he was going to try to dominate everyone else. Although privately he was saying things like that, and Mein Kampf had already said things like that, but he was promising greatness again to the German people.
So most people think of Adolf Hitler, they think of the epitome of human evil, they think of a deeply immoral man, and then they would thereby probably say there's no such thing as a Nazi ethic embodied by Adolf Hitler. Is that true?
Well, of course, I wrote a whole book called Hitler's Ethic, in which I try to show that that's actually not true. He was evil, that's certainly true, but he was evil, and this is interesting because I think a lot of secular ideology, I mean, think about Marxism and other kinds of things like that, a lot of secular ideology promise these utopias, and they promise, these great, grandiose things that they think will come about. But they do that on the basis of sometimes a wrong ethics, not that they don't have ethics, they'd have the wrong one. And in Hitler's particular case, he imbibed a version of a racist version of evolutionary ethics that believed that what's good is whatever helps advance humanity to a higher evolutionary stage, and what's morally bad is whatever leads to biological degeneration. So he did have an ethic, but it was an ethic based upon what he thought promoted the evolutionary good. And so if getting rid of people that he considered inferior, such as other races, such as people with disabilities and such, if getting rid of them would help improve the human race, then he saw it as a good thing.
We hear this now, obviously, with the perspective of hindsight, and we say this is totalitarian and disturbing at its most fundamental level. How was it that the German people and so many others heard that and said, you know, that is, the good is what advances human evolution to the next level, and bad is what holds us back.
Well, a lot of German scholars themselves were teaching similar things. Hitler wasn't in a vacuum. I mean, Hitler, in fact, imbibed a lot of ideas from other German Darwinists, and I talk about that extensively in my book, From Darwin to Hitler, about the roots that go back to the 1860s and 70s and on into the 1890s and early 1900s when Hitler was growing up, too. So he was building upon ideas that were not all that uncommon in the German academic world. Many people think of Hitler as being some sort of person just sort of crank, you know, buying all these crank ideas out on the streets and such. And there are some ideas that he held that were pretty maybe pseudo-intellectual, but there were actually a lot of German doctors, physicians, scientists who were upholding some of the same ideas that Hitler held. And I'm not saying they held all of the same ones, and I'm not saying they would have been as brutal as he was in applying them, but still a lot of the ideas that he put forward in Mein Kampf and elsewhere were not all that strange to German ears.
So rolling back to Darwin himself, did he conceive of his ideas as having an ethical dimension?
Well, Darwin, interestingly, does write extensively about the origins of morality in his book, The Descent of Man. And there he basically strips away any kind of absolute ethics because he believes that morality is an evolved trait. And, of course, it could have evolved differently. It's just sort of chance events that it's evolved the way it has. In fact, I was at a conference at San Diego State University in 2009 where this rapper named Baba Brinkman was giving this talk about Darwinian ethics. And he said, it's just a flip of the coin, just a chance that we happen to, you know, have the particular ethics that we have. And if we'd been like the Black Widow, and this is his example that he gave, he said, if we'd been like the Black Widow, then all of our ethical and religious systems would revolve around us eating our spouse after mating, the females eating their spouses after mating. So it's just a chance event that we happen to have this kind of ethics. Well, Darwin himself didn't use that example, but Darwin did claim that the morality that we have is an evolved trait and that it could have evolved differently. It did evolve differently in different species. And so he undermined any sense that there's any kind of objective morality. And although Darwin himself believed that love your neighbor as yourself was a good ethic, he talks about this, and he believes that in humans we have this cooperative ethos, nonetheless, he undermined the idea that there can be any objective morality.
So he was internally inconsistent. He was not a thoroughgoing moral relativist himself.
Well, he was in the sense that he thought that morality was not universal. He thought it could be different for different races, even, interestingly. Darwin was clearly a racist in the sense that he thought that different races had different intellectual qualities and also different moral characteristics. And so he did actually think that some races had different differences in their morality. So he didn't believe in any kind of universal ethics. But he did tend to believe that sort of what he considered sort of the higher ethic was this ethic of cooperation and such that he saw in the human species. But again, he undermined any basis for promoting that.
And like Adolf Hitler later, was Charles Darwin alone in his thinking?
By no means. I mean, he was buying a lot of ideas from others. I mean, he was unique in some of the ways that he put together his ideas, and that was one of the reasons he was able to convince a lot of people who hadn't been convinced before that time. But no, a lot of the ideas he was pushing and were fairly widespread, and certainly became widespread after he spread them.
Okay, so today the critique of kind of a very simple critique of Darwin, or of a ethics of Darwinism, would say, look, if we were thoroughly consistent in our view of evolution as the basis for any kind of free-floating ethical system, then we would kill to survive. We would do whatever it takes in order to prove ourselves fittest in this world. We are, after all, volitional beings. We don't have to succumb to the blindness of evolution. We can chart the course ourselves. Is it fair to assign that to someone like Charles Darwin?
Well, I'm not sure quite, and here's why. Let me give an example of someone, a contemporary, who I actually have interacted with and talked with, Michael Ruess, who is a prominent philosopher of science at Florida State University. He's one of the leading philosophers and historians of writing about Darwinism. And he and E.O. Wilson, who's one of the most prominent biologists around today at Harvard University, he's one of the founders of what's called sociobiology. Wilson and Ruess wrote an article in which they said that morality is an illusion fobbed off on us by our genes to get us to cooperate. Okay, so that's the fundamental view that he has of morality. However, if you start talking to him about issues like, you know, what you're talking about, well, then why don't we just kill people and these other things? He'll say, it's not how we as humans have evolved. We have evolved to have these cooperative instincts, and so I don't have it in me to do that, is the kind of way he would respond to that. But on the other hand, it seems to me, and I've talked with a number of people who sometimes admit this, although usually sheepishly, that they don't have any basis for telling someone else, like Hitler, for example, that what you're doing is wrong, that what Hitler did was an evil thing, and they've undermined their own basis for any kind of standard of morality, such that if someone else says, well, maybe I've evolved to kill people, you know, then they have no reason to contradict that.
So there's no principle established in their worldview by which they could say we shouldn't pursue that course, Hitler's course on a grand scale. No principle.
Correct. All they can say is, well, I've evolved to cooperate and I don't like that, but that's about all they can say.
How, just as an aside here, how do they, if they make an attempt, explain something like Adolf Hitler? An evolutionary dead end? How do they explain it?
Well, yeah, they could explain it as a devolution dead end since he lost. You know, they'd say, well, he lost, so he didn't pass on and he didn't reproduce either. So, except that actually Hitler did have Hitler did actually have a child. A lot of people don't know that, but he fathered a child during World War I by a French woman. But other than that, he only had one child, and that. But so he didn't reproduce and pass on his genes. That's what they would say. So yeah, he's an evolutionary dead end. But really, they have no way of saying that either. But if you go back to someone else, like Genghis Khan, who did leave lots of progeny, they have nothing to say about what would be wrong about Genghis Khan, you know, massacring peoples in Asia and, you know, raping women and all sorts of things like that, which he did. They have no way of saying that what Genghis Khan did was bad. After all, he did pass on his genes to the next generation.
On a grand scale, I mean, we're talking about 25% of the Asian world has some of his DNA floating around inside of them.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so let's talk about this term evolutionary progress that was defined as kind of the elemental good. What does evolutionary progress in the mind of the kind of the Darwinian ethic that progresses from Darwin to Adolf Hitler, what does it look like? What does evolutionary progress supposed to look like?
Well, that's an interesting question because, of course, if you take Darwin and sort of try to pin him down on whether or not there actually is any such thing as evolutionary progress, in some of his lucid moments, Darwin actually admitted that there wasn't any such thing as evolutionary progress because there's no purpose or goal toward which evolution is moving. It's completely godless, planless process. And many evolutionists today would still say the same thing, that there's no teleology, that is, there's no plan, no thing toward which evolution is progressing. It's just chance events that take place that, you know, are moving things along. Darwin did, in his Origin of Species, continually use the language of evolutionary progress. That is, he continually talked about higher beings, lower beings, and such. And so did most Darwinists in the late 19th and early 20th century. Usually what they're thinking of, especially when it starts getting applied to human societies, is they're thinking of people with greater intellectual powers. Sometimes they would say people with higher morality, too, and that's usually defined as being more altruistic and such, and then people with more physical prowess. So these are these three things are the physical prowess, the intellectual capabilities, and sometimes higher morality would be the things that they would think about when they're thinking about evolutionary progress. And so Hitler in particular was wanting to help to increase the numbers of people that had these kinds of characteristics. And here's an interesting thing, too, along the lines of what I'm just talking about. Moral qualities. Hitler thought the Aryan race was the most moral race on the planet. And of course, he thought the Jews were one of the most immoral races on the planet. He didn't necessarily think the Jews were the least intellectually. He probably assigned the black Africans or maybe even Australian Aborigines that position. But he thought they were one of the most immoral races. He constantly talked about their greed, their sexual lasciviousness, their laziness, and all these other kinds of things. Whereas the Germans, he thought, the Aryans, he thought, were diligent, loyal, truthful, and all these sort of good moral traits. And so Hitler thought that by eliminating the Jews, he's getting rid of immorality and promoting morality.
Dr. Richard Weikart is our guest. We're talking about the Darwinist roots of the Nazi worldview and the Nazi ethic on this Friday afternoon, August the 28th. We'll talk with him until the end of the hour. And when we come back, how do you organize an ethic that is built on blind, godless evolution? We'll get the answer to that question right after this. Why do the gospel accounts differ? Why did Jesus use parables? Are there demon-possessed people today? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August is the big book of New Testament questions and answers. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers is written by Dr. Michael Eschelbach of Concordia University, Irvine, California. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers.
The congregation at Lake George Lutheran Chapel is a proud sponsor of Issues Etc. We are located on the western shore of Lake George. Many of our members fish the area lakes, and on Friday, September 4th from 5 to 7, we are hosting our annual fish fry with the proceeds going to our annual organist fund, Lake George Lutheran, where fish are eaten and people are fed in the net of the gospel by Christ's means of grace. Sundays at 9 a.m., set your course to 1540 West 800 North, Fremont, Indiana. Like us on Facebook and find out more at lakegeorgelutheran.org.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM. That's lcms.org/RSTM.
Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What we need as a goal is to raise a generation of Christians who actually believe that truth is not a matter of opinion, that a college education, while good, is not more important than children, that a successful career, while fulfilling, is not more fulfilling than a faithful and steady marriage.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference,
where what we believe about who Jesus was and how he saved us influences how we treat each other all the time, where we teach his words because he's God, whether or not we like those words, and if we don't like them, our first action is not to try to make them go away, but to find out how and why they're right, where the good news is yelled every single day by all of us at our dinner table to our kids, listen, God is calling.
You can listen to Pastor Fisk's presentation, Making the Case for the Church's Response to Postmodernism, on an audio DVD from the Making the Case conference. For a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day, we'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo at issuesetc.org.
It's no different than a butcher shop saying, here's some extra parts of the pig that we can also sell. It's no different.
In Hitler's particular case, he imbibed a racist version of evolutionary ethics that believed that what's good is whatever helps advance humanity to a higher evolutionary stage.
It's not a war on women. We're helping them to become, in a more full way, what they were made to be, wives and mothers.
It's a really good media soundbite to try and divert the attention from where it should be, which is on the life of the child and the life of the mother.
The priest and the Levite are the law. They're on their way to the temple, and if they get involved in this, they're going to be rendered unclean and unable to do their service. They're the law, and so they pass by because they can't help.
1 hour from now, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Actually, you're going to play it. We just kind of direct the game. It's the listeners that play the game. They play by listening to the four soundbites that we have lined out for you this week. That was just a taste of them. And then giving us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or going to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. 1 hour from now, Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Dr. Richard Weikart is our guest professor of history at California State University and author of the book From Darwin to Hitler. We're talking about the Darwinist roots of the Nazi worldview. As this Darwinist ethic, so to speak, progresses, how do the major thinkers in this category, how do they organize an ethic that is built on blind evolution?
Well, interestingly, a lot of the organizing efforts for this came out of the eugenics movement. Interestingly, by the 1890s, there was a fairly influential, and certainly by the early 1900s, there was a fairly influential eugenics movement, which was a movement to try to improve human heredity. Now, this had gone back to Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, who had originated the eugenics movement in Britain, but it became very powerful in Germany. As well as many other parts of the world, too. There's been a lot of scholarship about the eugenics movement and the history of it and showing how it spread throughout the world. Germany had a very vigorous eugenics movement, and this was especially in the medical profession, also among scientists, that were wanting to improve human heredity. And in fact, they saw their goal as trying to push evolution forward. So these are ideas that were very prominent in German academy when Hitler was imbibing these ideas in the early part of the 20th century.
So there was the kind of the big societal or corporate morality, which was improve the race, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the United States, for example, the eugenics movement was also fairly strong in the early part of the 20th century. And so in 1907, Indiana passed a compulsory sterilization law. Other states followed suit, including California, where I am, and had a and they sterilized tens of thousands of people in the name of improving human heredity. And in 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court in Buck versus Bell ruled that that was permissible. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, who wrote the opinion, said three generations of imbeciles is enough. That was his way of characterizing the push in eugenics. And he, in private correspondence, Holmes claimed that he thought this was getting at the heart of real reform to push eugenics, pushing the eugenics movement.
So it was not just, it's a two-sided coin. Eugenics is one side. The other side is, as you point out in the book, there were those who were following this Darwinian ethic who believed that humanitarian efforts were counterproductive to this.
Right.
Talk about that, if you would.
Well, actually, both eugenics movement and the what I call the social Darwinists, the ones who are wanting more competition, both actually saw humanitarian efforts being counterproductive in certain ways. And for they often criticized Christianity and others for being too humanitarian, helping the poor, helping the weak too much, because they thought that then helps what they called the unfit to propagate the species. But they were wanting to try to find a way around that. And there were two different ways that some of the various thinkers found to try to get around that problem of humanitarianism. One was just to return back to more competition, you know, let people just duke it out among themselves in society. So they compete for the scarce resources, but they acknowledged that this was going to lead to mass death. Others wanted to sort of use more a bioengineering approach, that is, the eugenics movement of trying to use artificial selection. So instead of fostering natural selection, let's just artificially decide. You know, we'll decide who's going to be born, who's going to procreate, who's going to marry, and all other decisions like that to help get the species to go forward.
Where does active, what they would have called euthanasia, where does active euthanasia and abortion enter the picture?
Okay, when we're talking about euthanasia in this context, really in the very earliest days, a lot of it was actually not focused on assisted suicide, as we think of sometimes when we think of euthanasia. It was focused on killing the disabled, actually. And so going back to the 1870s, the very first person in Germany who promoted what was called euthanasia at the time, which was, in this case, infanticide for people with disabilities, was Ernst Haeckel, who was the leading Darwinian biologist in Germany. His 1870 edition of The Natural History of Creation, he suggested that infanticide would be a good idea for people who had especially mental disabilities and such. And then later on in 1904, in a book called The Wonders of Life, he expanded that to talk about euthanasia or killing of the disabled adults as well, which he thought should be done by physicians, a panel of physicians who would make that kind of determination. In Britain and the United States, U.S. it came a little bit later. Britain also, 1870, had some of the very first beginnings of discussions about euthanasia. And once again, it was very often couched in Darwinian terms. The discussion was about getting rid of the unfit so that they don't drag down society with their hereditarily bad traits.
Was abortion then just seen as of one cloth with that? That is, we're simply prophylactically eliminating the unfit.
Yes, there were those at that time who were also pushing for abortion for the same kind of reasons and promoting it, again, on the same determination. Interestingly, Ernst Haeckel, who promoted abortion, one of the earlier Germans to promote abortion also as a Darwinian, claimed that children, even once they're born, were not yet completely human. And so that's why he actually supported infanticide as well as abortion.
So this idea of race, it's one thing to talk about improving the race as kind of the big moral imperative of Darwinian ethics. It's another thing to talk about the purity of the race, which I think is often associated with the Nazi ideal. How do those two relate to one another?
Well, interestingly, Hitler in his program of biological improvement was looking both at improving the German race, and that's why he began killing the disabled in the compulsory sterilization program, which came before that. So they introduced a compulsory sterilization program, the Nazis did, in 1933. It actually began in force in early 1934. But then during World War II, in 1939, they began a program to kill the people with disabilities, especially those that were institutionalized. And by the end of World War II, they had killed about 200,000 Germans with disabilities, as well as people with disabilities, we don't know exactly how many, in occupied territories of Europe. So that was part of sort of purifying the German people itself to get rid of their bad biological characteristics. But then, of course, he also thought that Jews, and not just Jews, Gypsies, also Slavs and others were inferior biologically as races, and so he also wanted to try to get rid of those people who were identified as being inferior racially as well. So those two things are both going on. They're both part of this biological improvement.
Dr. Richard Weikart is our guest professor of history at California State University, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism in Germany. We're talking about the Darwinist roots of the Nazi worldview. When we come back, how do you go from a political goal, if you have this stratified view of race, that let's deport them, to what he was talking about? That is, let's exterminate them. Stay tuned.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues Etc. regular guest Craig Parton will present Christianity for the Academic and the Artist as part of the Village Lutheran Lectures on Christianity and Culture. Join us on Saturday, October 3rd, 2 p.m. at Village Lutheran Church, 9237 Clayton Road in suburban St. Louis. To learn more, go to villagelectures.com. Christianity for the Academic and the Artist, Saturday, October 3rd, 2 p.m., Village Lutheran, St. Louis.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the Scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Darwinist roots of the Nazi worldview. About another 10 minutes with Dr. Richard Weikart. Then Pastor Chris Rosebro joins us of Fighting for the Faith. It's This Week in Pop American Christianity. We will answer the question, why do these televangelists so often adhere and promote Jewish feasts and festivals, but not the Christian ones? Pastor Chris Rosebro, in about 10 minutes here on Issues Etc., then Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. Dr. Weikart, I want to back up from the euthanasia and from the kind of the Holocaust picture that is at the end of this Darwinist ethic and figure out how it got there. If you have this view of race, this Darwinist view of race, a stratified view of race, if your goals are only political, the first thing you say about the gypsies and the Slavs and the Jews is, let's deport them. How does it get from that to let's exterminate them?
Well, actually, interestingly, deportation was the first approach of the Nazis. When they came to power in 1933, they didn't begin annihilating Jews that year. They did try to introduce discriminatory measures and other things to try to make life miserable for the Jews in Germany, and hoping that many of them would leave, and many of them did. By 1939, when World War II began, about 60% of the Jews in Germany had left. So deportation was actually the first item on their agenda. In fact, in 1938, when they took over Austria, one of the first things they did is Adolf Eichmann went to Vienna and began organizing the deportation of the Jews, mass emigration of the Jews there. So actually, deportation was the first thing on the agenda. However, once the Nazis took over Poland in late 1939, let me back up and say that when the war began in September 1st, 1939, there were only about 200,000 Jews that were still left in Germany proper. But when they took over Poland, they gained 3 million Jews in territories they were occupying. And even once they took over these territories, and especially once they took over France, the SS began trying to set forward a plan whereby they were going to deport the Jews to Madagascar. There was a so-called Madagascar plan, because Madagascar had been a French colony. And so once they took over France, they were going to hope that they could take Madagascar and deport the Jews there. Of course, this was actually inherently genocidal, because they weren't expecting the Jews to live in Madagascar in luxury and, you know, have nice lives there. They were going to keep them in camps and such, and probably they would die off anyway originally. But there was actually programs for deportation. However, as this became less and less possible because of the war, it became clear that there wasn't going to be any way to deport them, with Britain still fighting and controlling a lot of the seas. And so once they began their incursion into the Soviet Union, which began in June 1941, that's when they actually began annihilating the Jews, because they didn't believe that they could deport the Jews practically.
Did the average German citizen, were they aware of this, and when made aware of this, is there any indication that there was some sort of moral impulse to say, okay, this ethic that we have either permitted or considered good up to this point has gone too far?
Well, the people who were actually carrying out a lot of the killings, which were largely SS units, but also some police units who were sent in, they were called Einsatzgruppen or commando squads, that were sent in behind the regular army to kill. The army did at times cooperate, but most of this was done by these special killing squads. The SS units were gung-ho, ideological Nazis, completely committed to Nazi ideology. There's not a lot of evidence that they had a lot of compunction, although they did consume a lot of alcohol, and so apparently it did weigh on them and their consciences and such after they would do these killing sprees and such. And in fact, Himmler finally decided that the reason they set up the death camps to use gassing was because of the problems, psychological problems they encountered with the SS squads having to shoot Jews. And very often they tried to offload that too, by the way, onto other, on Ukrainian auxiliaries or Latvian auxiliaries or others who they could get to do the dirty work for them as much as possible. In terms of what the German public on the whole knew, obviously this was not public information, and the Nazis did try to keep it as secret as they could. But especially with these mass killings going on the Eastern Front, and with lots of German men being sent to the Eastern Front, there were a lot of people who began finding out about the shooting of the Jews on the Eastern Front. And actually, even by 1945, at the end of the war, when the death camps had already been operating since late 1941, the first death camp opened in December 1941, even by 1945, most Germans, if you'd have asked them about Auschwitz, would not have had a clue what Auschwitz was or about the gassing of the Jews. They would be more likely to have known about the shooting of the Jews on the Eastern Front, because that was a little more open and more openly known. There were still Germans, of course, who wouldn't have known what was happening. People tried to close their eyes. The war's going on. I've talked with a man who lived there. He was only 12 years old, though, at the end of the war, and he didn't know until right after the war about what had taken place. But there were an awful lot of men on the Eastern Front who did know about some of it.
Okay, then what was this all supposed to be driving toward, this ethic that begins with the Darwinian ideas of race, of natural selection, of kind of a corporate morality to improve mankind, evolutionary? When it gets into the hands of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, what was the promise that was being made of following this ethic?
Well, interestingly, the ethic itself, interestingly, was not always laid out in real clear terms. Let me put it this way. So, I mean, Hitler wasn't going around Germany telling people, hey, we're going to annihilate other people to promote our race. Of course, he's not saying that. What he's saying is that we're going to make Germany great again. We're going to improve our race through eugenics measures. And the compulsory sterilization program was public knowledge. I mean, that was a public law that was passed, and everyone knew about the compulsory sterilization program. They didn't know, however, about the killing of the disabled in 1939 when that program began, although that began to leak out pretty quickly, too. It was a top-secret program, but the German public came to know about it fairly quickly. And actually, they shut down the killing centers to try to decentralize it, to try to placate the German public. So he wasn't telling people exactly what he was wanting to do, except among his closest associates, and except in certain what are called secret speeches, where he does actually lay it out a little more clearly and such. So in his propaganda, his public speaking, he's not always publicly laying out all of these things for people. He's promising to make Germany a great nation again, to get the economy going, to do this, but he's not always telling people all of his vision.
Finally, you write this kind of by way of summary. I'd like you to explain it, if you would. You say, in the hands of Hitler, morality could not be determined by any code of the past, but only by the effects it has on the evolutionary progress. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that there was no moral code such as the Ten Commandments or anything else, for that matter, or even Kantian ethics. There was no moral code, no objective ethics that was going to, he considered, binding. But the only way to tell what is good and bad, according to Hitler, would be by its effects, by what it produces. Does it produce evolutionary progress, or does it produce biological degeneration? And that would be the measuring rod to determine whether something's good or not.
Could there have been any Adolf Hitler, as we know him in history, without Charles Darwin's ideas?
That's very difficult to say, and I'm not, and I do want to be careful that I'm not arguing that Darwin's ideas led directly to Hitler. I don't argue that, but I do argue that without Darwinism, that certainly Hitler's ideology would have been inconceivable, and so I don't think that it would be the case that Hitler could have come to power with the ideology that he had, with the practice that he putting that ideology to practice, without there being Darwinism coming on hand before that.
Dr. Richard Weikart is professor of history at California State University, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism in Germany. You can purchase it at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find a link to the Discovery Institute there as well. Issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Weikart, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back in hour two of Issues, Etc., Pastor Chris Rosebro is going to join us. He does almost every week for This Week in Pop American Christianity. We're going to talk about televangelists and the upcoming Shemitah Festival and the fall Jewish feasts that televangelists seem to be rather fond of, even while they ignore most of the Christian feasts and festivals. Then we're going to play Issues, Etc., Soundbite of the Week. Our four soundbites are ready to go. And we'll take your votes in about a half hour, 35 minutes here on this Friday afternoon, August the 28th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We're what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.